You know the problem already?
What?
Before we even start this, yeah. I am completely intimidated by this guy. his bio and resume, or whatever, is about as long as my entire arm.
He's some smart guy, huh?
Yeah, he's...
Talk to us like we're four-year-olds.
Yeah, so, yes, that's why I tell a lot of people like that, too. I got to have it here. You got to keep it like I'm right here.
Yeah, but I think you're exaggerating my intelligence. I'll just talk to you adult to adult.
That's great. Now, thank you for coming in.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And then a nice meeting you, too. Had a nice conversation off the air about sports and, and the world in general. So
okay.
we're talking to Josh Kastenberg. UNM School of Law. I'm calling you a constitutional law expert. Is that okay?
I suppose it is, although I focus more on criminal law than anything else, but it's a subset of con law.
You came highly recommended.
Well, thank you.
So don't let us all down.
Okay. Best not to.
All right, let's do some, excuse me, let's do some traffic, and then we're going to get into this. All right. I'm going to read part of this, and then we'll get into a conversation.
Sounds good.
All right. Prior to joining the UNM Law School faculty in September, is this up to date? When did you join that?
So I joined in August of 2016.
I was like, okay, so you haven't been here that long.
No, I haven't.
Yeah. 20-year career as a lawyer and judge in the U.S. Air Force.
Oh.
Served as an advisor to the Department of Defense on cybersecurity.
Oh.
And cyber warfare matters, twice deployed to Iraq and oversaw the military's compliance with international law, served as a prosecutor and defense counsel in over 200 trials and as a judge in over 200 trials. I could go on, but we don't have enough time.
Please don't.
I guess he'll work.
So I guess
if that's all you can bring in, TJ.
I know. So you've been around the block a couple times.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, good. Well, good. See,
I have a teenage son. I've been around the block a few times.
Oh my God!
So,
you probably will know what I'm going to ask you and what we're going to be talking about. So let's just get right into this, sir. I mean, there's always been contention in Washington between the legislative and the executive branch, and now the judicial branch is coming in more into play, it seems, these days. Are these times normal, do you think? Has it been worse in the past than it is now, or what's your take on this?
It hasn't been worse since World War II. I mean, I think you could go back to the eve of the Civil War. I think you could go back to the fights between the anti-slavery politicians and the pro-slavery politicians, the 1850s. I think you'd go back to Andrew Jackson's presidency and you could find some really contentious times. But I think since 1945, we're at our lowest point.
Really?
I do.
Yeah. And I think the country in general, Brandon and I have talked about this. I mean, it's bad now, but then again, even in my history and probably your history as well, you're a little younger than me. The 60s were a terrible time.
They were.
For this country, too. I know Nixon was trying to put forth executive power as much as he could back then as well.
That's true. However, remember this about Richard Nixon's presidency. He gets elected in 1968, but he immediately faces a Democratic Party majority in the House and Senate.
Right.
So there was balance to it. And the parties were different then. There were Democrats who allied with Nixon. There were Republicans who were anti-Nixon.
Right.
Party labels didn't mean then what they mean today.
When do you think things started going south? if you could define a moment.
You know, that's a great question, but I really think I think Vietnam was a major changing point.
Right.
That goes to the 60s, I think. But I think there were recovery periods. I think there was a sense of unity under Reagan's presidency. I think there was an attempted sense of unity under Carter's before that. That sort of fell apart. But yeah, I think you can go back to the 60s, and there's an unraveling
right.
begins. And we haven't recovered from that.
No, and I think Carter was I wouldn't want to have been president when he was Carter, because what were the inflation rates of like 15-16% when he was president?
And a gas oil and gas crisis, right? The Iran hostage crisis, Soviet incursions into Afghanistan and other places as well. It was a messy time.
Yeah, no wonder he was a one-term president. All right, the president just had his state of emergency at the border voted down by the House and Senate. In response, he issued the first veto of his presidency. First of all, in your opinion, based on your wealth of experience and knowledge, does this constitute a national emergency?
I don't believe that the immigration issues on the border constitute a national emergency. But at the same time, because the Constitution itself doesn't define what a national emergency is. I think that a reasonable argument can be made that a president can declare a national emergency for things that his administration deems to be a national emergency.
Right.
However, that's a slippery slope. Where will it end?
Right. Yeah, I was just going to ask you to define a national emergency for me.
Well, you know, historically, yeah. It's been pretty clear. December 7th, 1941, September 11th, attacks on sovereign United States territory or on our allies. The Great Depression, 1929, you could consider to be a national emergency. Hoover took some extraordinary measures that were very un-Republican at that time.
Right.
That was a national emergency.
Well, then FDR's as well after that. I mean, he almost socialized the country back then, but he kind of had to.
Yeah, FDR lived a national emergency from 1933 until 1945 when he passed away. So, sure.
Yeah, interesting. All right, hold that thought. We have Professor Joshua Kasten. Josh.
Josh is fine.
All right, Kastenberg, UNF School of Law. All right, traffic, what's going on? Professor Josh Kastenberg sitting across from me right now. All right, obviously our president is a very divisive figure right now.
Yes.
And, I mean, obviously people on either side have very strong opinions about him positively and negatively. So you have the Mueller investigation, which will probably come out but eventually it's going to come out. Congress has voted 420-0 to make the entire thing public. What's your take on this? What could happen? What's our future hold?
Well, it appears to me that Bob Mueller, and who has, by all estimation, has an unimpeachable integrity in his character.
You said unimpeachable. You better not use that
true.
Term.
I'm not going to use that term again. Has a reputation for stellar integrity.
Sure.
Unbreakable. I think he's going to adhere to the law, but I also think he's going to adhere to DOJ policy, and that is that a sitting president cannot be indicted. So what I predict is that he won't make a recommendation to the House and Senate on what should happen to the president. Clearly, he's making important judgments on everybody else who are subject to indictment. So what will the public learn from the Mueller investigation? It depends on what parts of it become public. If it's just the cover sheet and his recommendations, we really won't know.
Right.
If it's the entire report, we'll know a heck of a lot.
Well, don't you think ultimately the entire report's got to come out?
Well, at some point it will, but you have to wonder, will it come out right away or will it be one of these 20-year release date type things? I believe it'll come out right away or shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
Amazon, you can pre-order it.
Seriously?
And the date is March 26th. So a lot of people think that maybe that's...
It's funded, but his investigation is funded through the end of the fiscal year, and they're still calling people to the grand jury. So I don't think March... That's a very optimistic date.
Yeah. Right. Well, we were talking about justices of the Supreme Court trying to remain as apolitical as possible. My God, he's getting it from both sides right now. Mueller is.
He is, absolutely.
Yeah. So the pressure on him has to be immense.
It does. But I'd also say to our listeners, watch what the New York Attorney General does, and watch what the Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance the III does, because they're making some really interesting moves on investigating the Trump Foundation and others. And while a state cannot remove a president, I could foresee an instance where the New York Attorney General goes to the House of Representatives and testifies, look, we have evidence of criminal wrongdoing from the White House. We can't do anything about it, but here, you please do it.
I was just going to ask you that about the Southern District of New York. As how this applies to the president, can he be indicted? He can't be indicted while he's president, like you said, right?
Well, that's DOJ policy. But, I've talked to people on the right and left, legal scholars, including Ken Starr, who you may remember was the chief prosecutor of the Whitewater investigation.
He was just in here.
Ken Starr believed, and I actually agree with him on this point, that he believed a sitting president can be indicted. It's just DOJ policy that was originally drafted by Robert Bork years ago that indicated a policy preference to the contrary.
Okay, so if the Southern District of New York, I guess the answer is obvious here, if they find indictable material, indictable charges, they could indict him, obviously, when he leaves office.
They absolutely could. And I also think they could indict a sitting president and keep it on, as a sealed indictment pending the president leaving office. Because keep in mind, every crime has a statute of limitations.
Josh Kastenberg, UNM School of Law. Thanks again for being here. This has been great. Thank you so much.